Thank you. Please have a seat, everyone. Appreciate you coming today. We are here today for a hearing on the new rules proposed by the Standing Committee on the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. Justice Coates and Justice Marquez are the liaisons to that committee. In light of his seniority, I've asked Justice Coates to preside over this hearing.
Thank you. Let me just point out first that the Standing Committee proposed a new comment to Rule 8.4 and a new Section 8.6 to us back in October. Shortly thereafter, we published a request for public comment, and we received a number of written statements, which we've all had a chance to review and we have before us. In addition to that, of course, we scheduled this hearing, public hearing, to give interested persons a chance to address the court. In order to get everybody in within a reasonable time, we've asked that you keep your remarks down to 5 minutes, with the exception of the chair of the standing committee, Marcy Glenn, and also the Attorney Regulation Council. And we've given them some more time, 15 minutes, to expand a little bit on the on their positions or the work of the committee. But also, we ask, because we've been informed there were some recent developments in Washington, which we had been following for various reasons, that they also comment on the situation in Washington. So with that, maybe we could get started. Let's begin with the chair of the standing committee, Ms. Glenn.
Thank you, Justice Coates, and thank you, members of the court. I have a little laryngitis, so please let me know if you can't hear me. You may regret giving me extra time. I appear as the chair of the court standing committee on the rules of professional conduct, which proposed the new Rule 8.6 and new comment 2A to Rule 8.4. Today, I hope to cover four areas. First, I'd like to briefly expand beyond my cover letter to the court about why the standing committee has proposed these amendments. Second, I'd like to address the arguments made by Mr. Coyle of the Office of Attorney Regulation Council. Third, I'd like to address the status of the rules proposed in the state of Washington. And of course, fourth, I'd like to respond to any questions that the court might have. The standing committee proposed these amendments because the rules of professional conduct should respect the will of the electorate of the state of Colorado. We all know that in two constitutional amendments, a majority of the voters of the state voted to approve constitutional amendments that would permit, under limited circumstances, the medicinal and recreational use of marijuana. The problem we have without proposed Rule 8.6 is that we have a vast number of citizens, businesses, and individuals in Colorado who cannot obtain the legal advice they need to proceed under those amendments and the regulations that have followed them. Rule 1.2D of the existing rules of professional conduct, as the court knows, unambiguously prohibits a Colorado licensed lawyer from advising a client or assisting a client in conduct that will violate law. And while the conduct that we're talking about would not violate Colorado law, it remains in violation of federal law. So that's the dilemma that we face. As I said, that leaves a number of potential clients without legal representation. This is especially true given the size of the marijuana industry, which is growing by leaps and bounds since the passage of Amendment 64. It's also especially true given the strong state public policy in favor of strong regulation of medicinal and recreational marijuana activities. And there is also a strong federal policy in favor of strong state regulation of marijuana use that's permitted under state law. We see that strong federal policy in what we call the Cole Memorandum, which Deputy Attorney General Cole, Federal Attorney General, Cole issued in August of 2013, which really changed the pre-existing federal enforcement position and articulated 8 federal enforcement priorities that the Department of Justice intends to pursue. The Cole memorandum emphasizes that it intends to leave to the states that have approved the use of medicinal marijuana or recreational marijuana enforcement of their state laws unless the activities of state residents begins to intrude into these other federal priorities, things like making sure that underage people, children, don't have access to marijuana, making sure that the use of marijuana and the marijuana industry does not become entwined with organized crime. Those are the types of federal priorities. When we read the Cole memorandum as saying, is that the federal government is content to leave to the states the regulation of marijuana in accordance with state law. And Colorado has responded to that, and responded to the passage of the constitutional amendments by enacting comprehensive regulations. But these are regulations that underscore the need for legal counsel. Businesses need to understand what they can and cannot do under Colorado law, and they're not getting that advice right now. The Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct in the scope section explain that the rules are designed to provide guidance to lawyers and to provide a structure for regulating conduct through disciplinary agencies. Right now, the rules lack that critical guidance, and that's why we are proposing Rule 8.6. I want to emphasize that the guidance that I'm talking about, the legal counsel, is not merely to what I'll call marijuana entrepreneurs, dispensaries, and other agents and individuals that want to get into the marijuana business. There's a whole other group of clients who are being deprived legal counsel by Colorado lawyers. Those are banks that want to be able to open bank accounts for these entities, vendors that are doing business with them, employers that employ users of marijuana and need to know to what extent they can take employment actions with respect to those employees, or who want to enact policies that comply with Colorado law. Individuals who are getting a divorce need to develop parenting plans where the other spouse uses legally under Colorado law medical marijuana, and they want to be able to write into the parenting plans provisions that will address that use. So it's not just marijuana entrepreneurs, but it's a broad range of Colorado businesses and residents who are not getting the legal advice they need. Turning to Rule 8.4 and proposed comment 2A. Currently, without the clarifying comment that we have proposed, Colorado lawyers risk professional discipline if they use marijuana either for medical reasons or recreationally in full compliance with Colorado law, because it is not clear from the existing rules whether or not violation of these federal laws, the Federal Controlled Substance Act, is a crime of moral turpitude that would permit discipline under Rule 8.4B because that conduct reflects adversely on the lawyer's fitness to practice or otherwise reflects adversely on the lawyer's honesty or trustworthiness. Now, on that issue, we do have a CBA ethics opinion, opinion 124, and the CBA has opined that a violation of the Controlled Substance Act for conduct that is in complete compliance with Colorado law, standing alone, should not be viewed as a violation of Rule 8.4B, should not permit discipline under that rule. But it's not clear, because we all know that the CBA ethics opinions are not binding on this court or in any courts, on the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel or on the presiding disciplinary judge. So it's for these reasons that the Standing Committee has proposed these rule amendments. Now, comments that the court has received reveal quite strong public support for these rules, principally from lawyers, but not exclusively. a majority of the standing committee, which studied and debated these proposed amendments at length, support the amendments. The CBA Ethics Committee supports them, as does the DBA and the CBA as a whole. The Municipal Attorneys Association has submitted a supporting letter, as has the Criminal Defense Law, Criminal Defense Bar, and so have a variety of lawyers in civil practice who represent both marijuana entrepreneurs, marijuana users, and in addition, these non-marijuana entrepreneurs, but other businesses that need legal advice and so are eager to have these proposed amendments adopted. Even the two comments submitted that oppose the proposed amendments support as legitimate or vital the goals of the amendments. And I'm referring to Mr. Rothrock's comments and to Mr. Coyle's comments on behalf of the Office of Attorney Regulation Council. The opponents merely argue that it's not necessary to state these rules in the rules because, in the view of Attorney Regulation Council, their existing enforcement position or policies are adequate to permit the conduct that we want to permit to occur without risk of disciplinary prosecution. But we disagree. The Office of Attorney Regulation Council's own website states that, quote, the standards for lawyer discipline are contained in the court rules and the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. The website does not say that internal Office of Attorney Regulation Council policies state the standards for lawyers. The standards are in the rules, and Colorado lawyers should not be put in the position of violating those rules, in particular, Rule 1.2D, in reliance on what Mr. Coyle is telling the court now. We appreciate the Office of Attorney Regulation Council's stated enforcement positions, but we do not believe that they are adequate under the circumstances. We do not believe that this court should subject Colorado lawyers to having to violate a clear and unambiguous court rule that says you may not do this simply because the Office of Attorney Regulation Council has said, do it, we're not going to prosecute you. The Office of Attorney Regulation Council emphasizes its prosecutorial discretion, which we agree it has, but it's that very discretion that causes us such concern. We don't know, and Colorado lawyers cannot know, whether the OARC will adhere to its current policies, whether those policies will change if and when there's a change in the administration of the office, or even whether, if the office administration remains unchanged in a particular case, the OARC will respect those policies in a given prosecution. It also may be an overstatement to describe the OARC policies as policies. We have yet to see anything in writing beyond the comment letter to the court. The sole citation for the policies in the comment letter is a comment by former Attorney Regulation Counsel John Gleason in response to a question in an article in a trade publication. And even Mr. Gleason's response back in 2012 only addressed what's covered by proposed comment 2A, in other words, the personal use of marijuana by lawyers. It did not address what is covered by new rule, new proposed rule 8.6, giving advice. Even Mr. Rothrock, who opposes the comments, concedes that Colorado lawyers, and I quote, cannot rely on a policy that they do not know about or cannot read. And they also cannot rely on a policy that could change at any time and that conflicts with at least one of the rules of professional conduct. Mr. Coyle's letter says that, and I'm quoting, Colorado lawyers who familiarize themselves with published disciplines and alternatives to discipline already know that an attorney's medical or personal use of marijuana in Colorado has not resulted in discipline or diversion in the past 13 years. That's on page 6 of the comment. And with respect, the vast majority of Colorado lawyers are not experts on this question of what discipline is allotted, and particularly here where the Office of Attorney Regulation Counsel is asking Colorado lawyers to draw a negative inference, to read all the discipline decisions, and then based on the absence of discipline related to marijuana use or marijuana counseling, to therefore conclude that it must be okay. We submit that that's a significant stretch and that it imposes an unfair duty on Colorado lawyers. They have a duty to know what the rules say, and that's why we ask the court to make these changes in the rules. It's also worth noting, and this is in Nancy Cohen's comment to the court, something I frankly haven't thought about, that because our discipline system is predominantly, if not exclusively, complaint-driven, the fact that there haven't been any prosecutions over time could very well be a function of the fact that many more lawyers are going to be asked to give advice on marijuana use now that the Amendment 64 has passed and the recreational marijuana has been legalized. The use, the industry, everything's going to grow exponentially. And so we won't be surprised if we start to see more complaints. And even if it's the position of OARC that they're not planning to prosecute these events, and I'd like these complaints, we all know what it's like to receive that letter that a complaint has been filed. We know the stress, the expense, the time that goes into responding to a complaint, even if it's not ultimately pursued. And we submit that Colorado lawyers should not even have to live with the threat of that under the very narrow circumstances covered by these rules. The other thing I'd just like to throw out there, I'm totally out of time, and I haven't even gotten to questions.
We'd like you to move along so we can stay close here, but particularly if you had any thoughts about the Washington situation.
Sure, I'll go right to that. The situation in Washington is that the King County Bar Association, which is Seattle, proposed rules that largely track what we've proposed. They were based largely on a prior version of what we've given the court, and they end up in the same place. That was in October. At the same time, the Bar Association issued an interim or an advisory opinion for interim purposes that would gave the same advice as what they were proposing in their rules. But again, it's not binding. The Washington Supreme Court agreed to consider those proposed rules on an expedited basis. It requested comments from the Washington State Bar Association. The Washington State Bar Association submitted those comments just last month, and I apologize that we did not get those to you sooner. The Bar Association does not support the amendments that King County submitted, but it proposed its own amendments consisting of two comments, one to 8.4, which is not terribly different from what we've proposed to 8.4, but in lieu of a new 8.6, the State Bar is recommending a comment to Rule 1.2 that would make clear that Rule 1.2 does not apply to any activities permitted, to giving advice on any activities permitted under Washington law. Two other important differences. Both of these comments would also cross-reference a proposed state ethics opinion that you now have that gives a lot more of the backstory to both of the proposed comments, explains why the Supreme Court, in reliance on the State Bar Association's Ethics Committee, is issuing the comments that it is. I'm not aware of any precedent in Colorado for a rule or a comment to reference and actually incorporate a CBA ethics opinion, but that's essentially what's happened, what's being proposed in Washington State. The other important difference is that the State Bar Association's proposed comments include limiting language that ties the comments to federal enforcement and reads, at least until there is a subsequent change of federal enforcement policy. The King County Bar Association has submitted a letter in which it explains why it does not think that the state bar approach is preferable, and the King County Bar Association continues to support its own amendments. I apologize for going over.
Let me see. No questions? Well, thank you very much. We appreciate
it. Okay, thank you very much.
Judge Berger, you want to be next?
Yes,
sir. By the way, I didn't say, but a number of people who are speaking are at least part of an organization or have some contact, and maybe you could explain what your relationship is as you start to speak.
May it please the court. I speak as a member of the subcommittee of the Rules of Professional Conduct Committee that was charged with developing these proposals. I also speak on behalf of Judge John Webb, who was the chairperson of that subcommittee, but was unable to be here today. Because the philosophy behind these proposals doesn't seem to be challenged by any of the people who submitted comments, I want to take my very limited time to address some of the matters that I think don't stand up, some of the objections made by the two main objectors, that is Regulation Council and Alec Rothrock, who is familiar to all of us, is a very knowledgeable legal ethics expert. First, this concept that if this court were to adopt these amendments, that the court would be giving a, quote, get out of jail free card to lawyers is really unfortunate rhetoric. It's nothing of the type. The guidance that these amendments, the comment and the rule would give, would do only one thing, and that is say that if a lawyer acts in conformance with those rules and the Colorado Constitution, that the Colorado disciplinary system, the Colorado Supreme Court, will not deem any violation of federal law that may result as a result of doing that as conduct that should subject a lawyer to discipline. There is nothing this court could do. These proposals don't ask this court to do anything regarding a safe harbor under federal law. Obviously, this court can't do that. No one is asking this court to do that. So to characterize this as a get-out-of-jail-free card is really misleading. And I ask you, if you have any questions about that, look at that carefully, and I think you will reject that characterization. Second, the idea that these rule changes are unnecessary fail by Regulation Council's own argument. Because if you look at the Rule 8.6 proposal, it's intended to address the question of lawyers providing legal services to people who need legal services, greatly need legal services, in connection with these tremendous changes in Colorado law. But if you look at Ethics Opinion 125, which was issued by the Colorado Bar Association Ethics Committee, that opinion tells you that a lawyer cannot, without risking substantial discipline, engage in, for example, representing a landlord who owns a building and wants to rent space to a marijuana store or dispensary. You can't do that because the Ethics Committee said, reading the plain language of Rule 1.2D, because it still potentially violates federal law, that it would be a violation of Rule 1.2D. So the idea that there is authority out there, and our ethics committees really aren't authority in the traditional sense of the word in any event, but suggesting that there is authority out there that would give guidance to Colorado lawyers to allow them to do what Regulation Council says they ought to be able to do, even though they don't want the amendments. They don't dispute the underlying necessity of Colorado lawyers being able to do that. It fails on its own terms because Ethics Opinion 125 says you cannot do it. So that doesn't work. One of the other principles, if you will, is trust me or trust us. This is from Attorney Regulation Council. And I trust Jim Coyle. He's a friend of mine. He is a person of great integrity. But that's not the point. That's not the way our system works. We don't hand authority to public officials and say, do what you want, just do it right. We're a society of laws, not of men and women. And just to say that, trust me, is just plainly insufficient under our system of government. Finally, the concept of discretion. Regulation Council says it needs discretion, and it does. But it doesn't need discretion to investigate conduct that the Colorado Constitution says is lawful. We tolerate discretion among public officials because it's necessary to run our government, but we don't tolerate giving discretion to investigate conduct that is lawful. And under the Colorado Constitution, this is lawful. Thank you very much.
No questions? We have next listed Mr. Gerald Pratt from the CBA. Mr. Pratt.
May it please the court, good afternoon, and thank you for allowing me to speak. My name is Jerry Pratt, and the Colorado Bar Association has asked me to present its position in support of both of these proposals. I've been a member of the Colorado Bar since 1981. I've served on the Ethics Committee since 1984, 30 years now. I'm a former chair of that committee. I also serve on the Lawyers Professional Liability Committee, and I've been chair of that since 2011. The Colorado Bar Association submitted the proposed proposals to all of its sections and committees and got their input. Based upon that input, they support both of these proposals. It's important to know that there is significant uncertainty among lawyers in Colorado about what they can do and what they cannot do ethically when it comes to marijuana issues. Can they be professionally disciplined for using marijuana in compliance with Colorado law, as other individuals are permitted to do? Can they be professionally disciplined for counseling and representing clients to comply with Colorado marijuana laws? For several years now, the Ethics Committee has received numerous inquiries from lawyers about what ethically they can do and not do. Law school professors from both the University of Colorado and the University of Denver have inquired of the Ethics Committee what is ethically permissible with regard to marijuana laws. The National Organization for the Reform of Marijuana Laws has inquired of the Ethics Committee, as has the ACLU. Judges are uncertain. We have several judges that serve on the Ethics Committee, and questions have arisen in a family law context when the parties work out a parenting agreement or a separation agreement that contemplates whether one of the parties can use marijuana, whether they have to refrain within so many hours before exercising their parenting time. When those kind of agreements are worked out regarding citizens who are complying with Colorado law, is it ethically permissible for the attorneys to engage in those agreements and the courts to approve those agreements? There has been media interest. Judge Talman, in his letter to the court, cites the Denver Post. I personally have handled an inquiry from the Durango Herald. The inquiries were significant enough that the Ethics Committee undertook to issue a couple of formal opinions, Opinion 124 and Opinion 125. They struggled with the issues involved there. Opinion 125, as Judge Berger pointed out a minute ago, says, based on the plain language of Rule 1.2D, there is certain conduct involved in advising and representing clients to comply with Colorado law that would be considered unethical under Rule 1.2D. There is a need for these changes. There is a need for the rules and the comments to be clear and open and direct. And Attorney Regulation Council says it's not an enforcement priority. But that is not looking ahead prospectively. And attorneys need to have some idea of what they can do ethically looking ahead in their conduct. And it's not much assurance to say it's not an enforcement priority for Attorney Regulation Council. What is binding, what is controlling, is what the rules say. If the Colorado Bar Association supports both proposals, there is a need for both of those changes, and this court has the opportunity to be direct and forthright and say in the rules and the comment exactly what those parameters are. In Mr. Coyle's comments to the court, he says that his office is in agreement with the substance of the proposals, but just doesn't think they need to be in the rules. As the other speakers have said, they do need to be in the rules, because that's what's controlling and that's what guides attorneys' conduct, not whether or not retroactively attorney regulation will consider an enforcement priority. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Mr. Bratt. Appreciate it. Judge Talbot, could we hear from you?
Good afternoon, Justice Coates, Chief Justice Rice, and other members of the court. I appreciate this opportunity to address you this afternoon and expand on my written comments that I've submitted and that I know you've read. Because of the limited time, I will focus my comments on urging you to adopt the new Rule 8.6. I'm not speaking here on behalf of any entity, but I wish to share my perspective as the immediate past chair of the Ethics Committee of the Colorado Bar Association, and having presided over numerous discussions involving both formal opinions 124 and 125. I think that a new rule 8.6 is needed to modify and elaborate on Rule 1.2D, because Rule 1.2D has been subject to multiple different opinions. As you know, there have been two very different law review articles. There have been different opinions from the ethics committees from Arizona, Maine, and Connecticut. So it's not clear how the language in Rule 1.2D should be interpreted under those circumstances. Also, I have had the opportunity to research the development of Rule 1.2. As far as I can tell, there was never any discussion of the application of Rule 1.2D to any conflicts between state and federal law. So I think we're really dealing with the application of Rule 1.2D to a situation that wasn't contemplated by the drafters of that rule. I also think the new rule is needed because, as Marcy Glenn has explained, issues involving marijuana extend to many areas of practice of law, in addition to the areas that she and Judge Berger and Jerry Pratt mentioned. The Denver Post had an article about how these issues arise in the area of homeowners associations. We've had cases in our court involving criminal law also raising issues about marijuana, and I think it's important to be able to provide clarity to lawyers as to whether or not they can represent clients in this area. I think it's also worth noting that we now have 51 pages of statutes in the Medical Marijuana Code and the Retail Marijuana Code that people have to interpret, and if they have to interpret them without lawyers, it's that much more difficult. And of course, in addition to that, we have local regulations and ordinances. I'd like to explain also why I think the Ethics Committee did what I think is fairly unusual, which was to adopt formal opinion 125, which I think is fairly restrictive in terms of its advice to lawyers, and at the same time also recommended that the Supreme Court adopt the Standing Committee's new proposed rule. I think the members of the Ethics Committee recognize that there has always been a symbiotic relationship between the Ethics Committee and the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct. So sometimes formal opinions are proposed, which lead to the development of rules, and those in turn may lead to revised opinions. A good example of that is formal opinion 101 on unbundling, which was promulgated by the Ethics Committee, which led to various rules that were adopted by the Supreme Court, which in turn led to a revision of the formal opinion. Another thing that I want to point out is that what we're dealing with here is what I would call a new federalism. There was an article in the written by the Associated Press last year that pointed out that 40 states now have enacted state laws that are in apparent violation of federal law, not only in the area of marijuana, but in the areas of gun control, health care, and ID requirements for driver's licenses. So the issues that we're dealing with here are not unique to Colorado or Colorado and the state of Washington, but are likely to arise in many parts of the country. I would like to conclude by reminding you of the language that Justice Brandeis used in his well-known dissent in 1932 in referring to states as laboratories of democracy, when he said, it is one of the happy accidents of the federal system that a single courageous state may, if its citizens choose, serve as a laboratory and try novel social and economic experiments without risk to the rest of the country. I trust that you will not create a risk, but that you will serve as an example to the rest of the country. Thank you very much.
Thanks very much for your comments, Judge. I think we've got Mr. Turner next on our list. You ready?
Thank you, members of the court. I'm appearing today on behalf of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar, and I'll be brief. Not once, but twice, the voters of this state have reached beyond the General Assembly to sanctify the use of marijuana, first medically and then recreationally. Although this has been characterized as an experiment in democracy, I think it's gone beyond the experimental stage. And in fact, it represents the future. It's incumbent, we think, on this court to then deal with that, whether we have a history of criminalizing marijuana use or not, that's behind us. I suspect there may be some reluctance to delve in and pass a rule that deals with something that just as recently as a few months ago was a crime, but nevertheless, the times have changed and the voters have mandated that change. There seems to be no way around opinion 125's logic. If you agree, as most of us here today seem to agree, that 1.2D forbids the advice that we all think is necessary, then we don't see any way around the need to amend the rule. Because lawyers are entitled to the same due process in their regulatory system as many others are entitled to, including, in our experience, of course, criminal defendants. Anything short of a rule change leaves us with this trust the enforcers mantra. And as much as we do trust the enforcers, perhaps it's best to say that we should trust but fortify. Ms. Cohn in her letter makes some good points, one of which you heard about. The Amendment 64 is liable to trigger more complaints along these lines. But she also points out that regulatory compliance means a clear set of rules, and we couldn't agree more with that. Finally, the failure to issue a rule at this point, now that it's percolated up to you and been postured as it has, could very well be seen as setting a precedent that the conduct involved is not clearly defined. One could feel that if the court chose not to act at this juncture, there's some uncertainty as to whether lawyers can, in fact, continue the status quo. That in itself would be chilling. We urge you not to do that. So for all the reasons we've set forth and in our letter to you, we ask that you pass some rule, whether it's the postured rule or the one that's implied by regulation counsel. but give us something in writing that we can rely on. Thank you.
Thank you. And we have on our list a request from Zane Gilmer. Thank you.
Thank you, Justice Cook. Members of the court, my name is Zane Gilmer, and I'm an attorney with the law firm of Perkins Coie here in Denver. I don't appear here to on behalf of any particular organization, but simply as a practitioner. My practice focuses on business litigation, compliance, white-collar crime, and investigations. As part of that practice, we regularly represent financial institutions and banks. And I submitted comments to the court in support of the adoption of proposed Rule 8.6 because I think the developments in federal and state marijuana laws and regulations beg for legal assistance. That is true not just for the marijuana industry, but for other industries as well. Again, the reason I'm here today is to talk about these other industries that are indirectly affected by the marijuana industry, specifically the financial industry. The financial industry faces unique and complicated compliance challenges. Those issues range from legal and practical implications from extending loans to landlords, that turn around and use those proceeds from the loan to provide commercial space to a marijuana-related business, to providing banking services directly to the marijuana industry. Banks, for their part, have been reluctant to provide services directly or indirectly to the marijuana industry, largely out of fear of running afoul of their federal anti-money laundering obligations, which are found in the Bank Secrecy Act. The financial industry's apprehension about getting involved in the marijuana industry has garnered a lot of public attention because of the public safety concerns that it has caused as a result of creating this cash-only business model. It's garnered so much attention that on February 14th of this year, at the urging and direction of the President of the United States and the U.S. Attorney General Holder, the Department of Justice and the Department of the Treasury's Financial Crime Enforcement Network, also known as FinCEN, issued guidance to the financial industry on this very issue. One of the FinCEN's stated goals was to clarify, quote, expectations for financial institutions seeking to provide services to marijuana-related businesses, end quote, and to, quote, enhance the availability of financial services for and the transparency of marijuana-related businesses, end quote. The guidance goes on to set forth comprehensive framework the financial industry should follow in order to comply with their anti-money laundering obligations under federal law. Despite the recent developments in federal law, Colorado lawyers are still ethically prohibited from assisting those financial institutions in complying with the new guidance. Just yesterday, 16 members of Congress, including Ed Perlmutter, submitted comments to other federal banking regulators, including the FDIC, and encouraged them to adopt FinCEN and DOJ's financial industry guidance to give further security to the financial industry, to entice them to take over and allow banks or allow the marijuana industry to get banking services, to get rid of this public safety concern. It is for these reasons that I submitted comments in support of the adoption of proposed Rule 8.6. I also want to note that in reading the comments submitted related to the proposed rule, I'm concerned that the proposed rule will either be interpreted or amended to exclude lawyer conduct that relates to money laundering in the marijuana industry, such that I just discussed. For instance, Mr. Coyle suggests that the language that is in the proposed rule, quote, standing alone may violate federal criminal law, end quote, should be changed to, quote, violate the Controlled Substances Act, end quote. If that interpretation of the rule were adopted, that would not only ethically prohibit lawyers from assisting financial institutions in complying with the new federal banking guidance, but it would subject them to, or because it would subject them to federal money laundering laws that exist outside the Controlled Substances Act itself. It would also affect every single lawyer that was dealing directly with the marijuana industry itself, because every dollar that they took for their services would be proceeds of an illegal transaction under the federal anti-money laundering laws. Therefore, I hope that if this court adopts this rule, it takes into consideration these concerns and includes them in any adopted rule.
May I ask a clarifying question? Are you suggesting we adopt a language that's here, adopt an amendment that you're going to propose, or not adopt Mr. Coyle's suggestion? I'm not sure which one.
Thank you, Justice Hobbs. I think to clarify, under the current proposed rule, I think as it reads, as it's sort of the broad language of under federal criminal law, it would protect, from an ethical standpoint, lawyers in Colorado, as far as the anti-money laundering laws go. I don't believe, however, if Mr. Coyle's suggested revision is adopted, that it would take into account federal anti-money laundering laws.
Thank you very much. Appreciate your comments. Lauren Maiden.
Chief Justice Rice, Justice Coates, members of the court, I appreciate the opportunity to address you. My name is Lauren Maiden. I'm a partner with the law firm of Edson, Maiden & Metz. We have an office in Denver, and I drove from our Aspen office this morning to address you. I worked on the drafting and the passage of Amendment 20. I also worked on the passage of Amendment 64. I was admitted to the bar in 1998, and I spent time both in private practice and with the Colorado State Public Defender's Office. I am on the board of directors for Colorado Normal. I'm also a member of the Colorado Criminal Defense Bar. I'm not here on behalf of either. I currently focus my practice on criminal defense and the multifaceted marijuana industry. I'm here on behalf of them. My clientele are those accused of crime, as well as banks, parents, employees, doctors, patients, MMC owners, OPC growers, MIP owners, their employees, their contractors, their subcontractors, and a host of other entrepreneurs. The Colorado Supreme Court Standing Committee on the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct concluded that the plain language of the Colorado Rules of Professional Conduct 1.2D prohibits lawyers from assisting clients in structuring and implementing transactions which by themselves violate federal law. Albeit a correct reading of the current rule, this conclusion prohibits good lawyers, good Colorado lawyers, from drafting operating agreements or drafting leases. It prohibits good Colorado lawyers from providing advice on how to structure a sale or advise a business client on how to word their purchase agreement so that they are compliant with state law, compliant with municipal law, and compliant with the Marijuana Enforcement Division laws. The marijuana industry should not be deprived of this integral legal representation on matters so complex that one wrong decision can land an unsuspecting entrepreneur, a landowner, a doctor, or a patient into facing a class 2 felony, drug felony, a class 3 drug felony, class 4 drug felonies, or, in the alternative, a multi-million dollar loss of money. Those are big stakes. The marijuana industry is booming. When A64 passed, medical marijuana was already generating well over $300 million a year in sales. With A64, it's expected to double, if not triple, in sales volume this year. This industry requires competent and experienced legal counsel. This industry requires counsel that doesn't fear disbarment. For counseling clients on how to be compliant with Colorado law, with how to be compliant with Colorado regulations, with how to be compliant with Colorado's various municipal rules, regulations, and ordinances. The citizens of Colorado want to participate in this industry. They want to do so, though, with a sense of dignity and pride, knowing that they're compliant with all of the applicable state and local rules. The participants in this state legal industry want a lawyer to ensure they're making the right choices. They want to be ensured that they're being steered in the right direction. Who is better equipped? Who is better equipped than Colorado's lawyers to give these people the advice they need and desire? They seek us out. I am one of these lawyers. In Colorado, a lawyer should be entitled to ethically counsel a client on legal matters expressly permitted under Colorado law, despite the fact that such conduct violates federal law. Because of this conflict, it is incumbent upon every lawyer, myself included, to advise my clients of this conflict. To advise my clients of the activities that are legal under Colorado law simultaneously violate federal law, and that the federal government has issued guidance on their enforcement directives. The clients need to know this. They need to get reliable advice. I urge you, on behalf of all persons in the marijuana industry, all people tangentially affected by the marijuana industry, and the lawyers who provide advice to those in this industry and those tangentially involved in the industry, to follow the recommendations of your standing committee, the Rules of Professional Conduct, and change these rules so that licensed attorneys can ethically counsel clients on state legal activities without fearing disbarment. We are in this great democratic experiment together. Let us experiment wisely with legal scholars guiding our way. Thank you.
Thank you. We also have signed up to speak Summer Luther, and I haven't seen. All right, Mr. Coyle, we'll jump straight to you.
Thank you, Justice Coates. May it be yours. I'm here today to emphasize some of the points that Ms. Maitland made. I'm here as on behalf of clients, and particularly client protection, rather than changes to the rules that could affect and harm client protection. And so I'm approaching this with an open mind. I'd love to hear from the court any questions, and I really don't want to discuss the personal use issues that much. I think I've handled that in the letter, and that doesn't deal with client protection. So I'm really not interested in that as much as I am the Rule 1.2D issues. And so what I'd like to do first is just talk a little bit about the policy, public policy interests that have been raised today, and there are some very good points raised today. First, as Ms. Maitland talked about, clients need competent legal representation. They should have competent legal representation. They should have diligent legal representation, conflict-free representation, everything that the rules of professional conduct require. And so our position has been, and I'm not, when I say our, I'm not just talking about the Office of Attorney Regulation, previous regulation counsel, or me, or the members of my office. I'm talking about the regulatory system that this office, that this court created in 1998, and that includes citizen participation by the Attorney Regulation Committee, as well as the presiding disciplinary judge and the hearing boards, which serve in this capacity. So, number one, consumers of legal services in this industry, which is legal under Colorado law, and which has been given the yellow light by the federal authorities, should be able to receive representation and counseling. I don't disagree with that. I don't think the system has disagreed with that over the past 13 years. Also, kind of an unstated but implied priority in the discussion today is that consumers really should have choice in their selection of an attorney. And that's an important public policy consideration. That if they have a present lawyer who's afraid of, who's hesitant of participating, giving them counseling, that that's a concern. And I would like to somehow figure out a way to address that problem, because consumers should have the right to representation of their choice. Not to say that those lawyers, like Ms. Maitland, who are giving representation now, aren't providing that, but rather consumers should have a variety of choice from a great selection of attorneys. So we have those two public policy interests in the formation of any kind of rule. We also have what Mr. Turner described as lawyers are entitled to due process. When you read Rule 251, the rules concerning discipline and disability, I think one can recognize lawyers do get considerable due process throughout the state, an amazing amount of due process. And that regulatory compliance means clear direction. I don't disagree with that concept as well. I think those are all good policies. On the other hand, the particular rule or any Supreme Court rule also puts this court in an unusual position of creating a rule that is in conflict with federal law, that just is unusual, and it creates issues and considerable issues, and I have concerns about that. But primarily, my concern about Rule 8.6 in particular is that it doesn't protect consumers of legal services adequately. No matter what the intent of the drafters are, when you read that rule, it is not clear. It is not unambiguous, and it is rife with difficulties. And so when the Standing Rules Committee is dealing with this issue and trying to increase lawyer participation in this, we also have to remember on the other end that what our office deals with is the dishonest, sometimes incompetent, or malevolent actor who uses the disciplinary process to delay, obfuscate, and create greater consumer harm, that the rule has to be clear and give direction and guidance. And I don't think 8.6 does that. So there are a couple of alternatives that are available to the court if the court is willing to entertain this. Proposed Rule 8.6, which I have concerns with. It has 13 clauses that are strung together. It's located at the back of the rules of professional conduct, and I don't know whether that was an intentional act or not, but when you read the rules of professional conduct, they're really quite organized. And the first section is the very heart of the attorney-client relationship. It deals with the attorney-client relationship. And that's the competence rule, the diligence rule, all that. That's right up in front. And that's where 1.2D is, because 1.2D is primarily involved in the attorney-client relationship. There's a little twist, because it talks about counseling or assisting. And that assisting may go beyond the attorney-client relationship a little bit. But otherwise, 1.2D is very much a part of the attorney-client rules section. Not at the very end, the comprehensive 24/7 rules. And 8.6 being at that very end, with that language notwithstanding any other provision of these rules, which, when I read it, and I'm trying to imagine a hearing board 2 years later reading it, thinking, well, does that cancel out 1.1, the competence requirement? Does that cancel out the diligence requirement and other duties owed to clients? That concerns me. I don't think it's very clear, even though it goes back to standing alone may violate federal criminal law. Those 13 clauses, when you read them and try to imagine applying them to the disciplinary cases that we see, I think that's going to be a very difficult and impossible situation to prove, because not only do we have to prove those elements of each disciplinary offense, we then have to prove it in effect us by clear and convincing evidence that it was each of the elements of 8.6. And I think that really makes it difficult. I think it's going to create a tremendous amount of litigation, particularly with some of the situations that our office deals with where we're trying to protect the public where we're trying to protect future clients and, in effect, the administration of justice and the legal profession as well from those dishonest or incompetent providers. So if there is a rule, I ask that it be simple, it be succinct, and it be a part of Rule 1.2. I mean, if we're talking about Rule 1.2, add one sentence at the end of 1.2, and I think Mr. Berger, actually, his language explaining the rule is pretty good. Have, after the language of 1.2, say, an additional sentence, if a lawyer acts in conformance with the Colorado Constitution, and I would add, and in compliance with federal enforcement guidelines, the Colorado Supreme Court, this rule shall not constitute a violation of the rule, something like that. I have another language that, as a possibility, at the end of 1.2, a lawyer shall not be in violation of this rule for counseling or representing clients regarding marijuana use or commerce that is lawful under Colorado law and that is consistent with federal guidelines concerning marijuana enforcement under the Controlled Substances Act, referring to the Controlled Substances Act, because I think it is important to restrict it not to every federal law, but rather the majority of discussions throughout up until Mr. Gilmer's comments were always about the Controlled Substances Act. If a lawyer violates the money laundering laws of the federal government and is prosecuted by the federal government, I hope our office can discipline that lawyer. And under the present reading of Rule 8.6, I don't think we would be able to, and that's a great concern. I have problems with that. Another alternative is what was proposed by the Washington State Bar Association, a simple comment. And a comment gives greater flexibility. It doesn't put the court in the position of creating a rule that's in conflict with federal law. It gives guidance to lawyers, and so it respects the rule of law, the U.S. Constitution, everything about it, but it also gives guidance to the lawyers and to clients. So I think a comment could be a good solution to some of these issues. And the Washington Supreme Court comment was pretty darn good. And this could easily be changed to language for Colorado. Since the passage out, I'm just going to insert Amendment 64, or Amendment 29, Amendment 64 by Washington voter, by Colorado voters. Both the federal and state government have devoted considerable resources to allowing these constitutional provisions to come into effect without regard to federal controlled substances laws, as long as certain stated federal concerns regarding matters such as sales to minors and other unlawful conduct are addressed. At least until there is a subsequent change of federal enforcement policy, a lawyer who counsels or assists a client regarding conduct permitted under the Colorado Constitution does not, without more, violate Colorado RPC 1.2. It's simple. It's restricted to 1.2D. It doesn't have continuing reverberating effect. When I read the newspaper this week alone, today, there's an article about the United Nations International Narcotics Control Board, which is the monitoring agency for the United Nations International Treaties on Drug Policies, talking about the US and Uruguay being in violation of international treaties for its states, the Washington and Colorado proposals dealing with marijuana. Those are nuances that none of us can necessarily predict. Every day there are new articles. There are articles yesterday about U.S. Attorney Walsh testifying before Congress on issues and whether marijuana should be a controlled substance or not. Good discussions, but they create nuances every day. This weekend, there's this, and I'll get a little a reaction from this, but this weekend they're talking about, there was a discussion about these shelters that were built on escape patrols and where people would smoke marijuana. And I can see a circumstance where somebody may get prosecuted for violation of public consumption on federal land. The U.S. Attorney's Office would have that. A violation, when we would look at it, we'd say, well, understand that's a violation of law. Does it reflect adversely on a lawyer's fitness to practice law? No. We probably conclude in those facts alone, no. But what happens if the next weekend they go skiing again and they do it again, knowing about the consequences the last time and the week after that? And instead of it just being a violation of use of marijuana, it becomes a continuous open violation of federal law. The Federal Committee on Conduct takes up the case. The Federal Committee on Conduct decides under their rules, because they probably would not, if there's a rule change, they probably wouldn't adopt the Colorado rule, even though that they've adopted the Colorado rules in bulk with a couple of exceptions. They could impose discipline and then send it over to us for reciprocal discipline. And we're faced with the issue of continuing violation of a certain circumstance. At what point does that raise a concern where discretion is needed on that type of issue, where there's that repeated violation that maybe the lawyer shouldn't get the break if they're constantly reminded of this circumstance and that this is a violation, they've been convicted of this federal law? So those are my comments. I want to address a couple of other statements. Judge Berger described the letter that I wrote as a trust us, we're not going to prosecute type thing, and that individuals shouldn't have that decision-making process standing alone. And I agree with that. And that's why, again, the court created the regulatory system that it has, that no individual, no regulation council acts alone on this. It's hard to get through the 20 lawyers in our office. Sometimes we have a vigorous debate on each and every issue that comes before us. Then we go before a very robust citizen group of 6 lawyers and 3 non-lawyers who act as the reasonable cause determiners. And we listen to what they say, and we know whether or not to proceed with another case with that issue. And then even if they say yes, then we go before the presiding disciplinary judge and hearing boards, who also have opinions, who may choose not to impose discipline. So it's not a trust us as in trust COIL or trust the Office of Attorney Regulation. It's you do have to trust the system, and the attorney regulation system works pretty darn well and has worked pretty darn well in addressing these issues. So I know my time's up, but if the court has questions, I'd be.
Can I ask one question? Good afternoon, Mr. Coyle. Did you propose this language to the committee, or what's the process there?
No, Justice Bowright, we did not. We did participate in the subcommittee discussions and the full committee discussions over the year. I've got to be honest with you, this everything in this area is changing quickly. We did not propose the language I just gave to Evan at the committee level. No.
All right, thank you.
Further questions?
I'm assuming the court were to vote that you go back to the table and discuss some of these things, that of course you would.
Yes.
And we also have a heavy responsibility. I recognize the public, but personally, I don't have a lot of confidence in all the ramifications you mentioned here without the good, competent assistance of our Colorado lawyers advising business people. And I for one, think that the municipal attorneys made a very good point here, that they need help with the crafting of local laws and regulations, what people can and cannot do. And I lack guidance from your testimony with respect to a workable set of rules that allows us not to discipline an attorney for giving good, practical, and sound legal advice. And I'm just now I'm kind of at sea here with what the way you presented your testimony.
Okay. Well, Justice Hobbs, I want to join in the concept that municipal attorneys should be advising their clients, that all government attorneys should be able to advise their interests, that all banking regulation attorneys should be able to advise their clients, that it's a very important part of the system. That which goes to the very essential part of the attorney-client relationship, you know, the counseling and assisting, yes, that we, any way the court chooses to address that, give that guidance and assurance to the court. If the court feels comfortable with the rule change, that's obviously I can live with that. The office can live with that. The system can live with that. But make it a simple and understandable rule change that provides guidance to the lawyer and the public and the system in our office so we can enforce it properly. That's no problem whatsoever. Again, I come as a consumer protection individual. That's my job, is to ensure that all Colorado lawyers provide competent legal advice, diligent legal advice, fulfill their professional responsibilities, and regardless of what industry they're in, all consumers of legal services receive that type of advice.
Well, one further question, is it really wise, though, in the terms of a shifting prosecutorial policy on the federal government to hitch our rule to whatever that may be in any given day or week?
Well, it's a difficult situation for any rule because it then is a carved, it's a snapshot in time as things develop. No doubt that whatever rule, if the court chooses to go the rule route, that rule may have to be revisited on a regular basis. When Ms. Maitland was talking about the financial implications, you know, and the amount of money involved in the industry, you know, there are 13 states that now have initiatives similar to Colorado and Washington and the District of Columbia. One of them is California. I think if they say that if California goes and legalizes it, the ninth largest economy in the world, that's going to be an $18 billion a year industry just with that additional state. And so every act that occurs every week, things develop. And so if there's a way to do it that's limited to 1.2D advice and it gives direction to attorneys, I'm all for it.
Hearing no other questions, thank you, Mr. Coyle.
Thank you.
Before I turn the gavel back over to the chief, let me just thank everybody for all the time and effort you put into this. We appreciate the written comments, especially that you did, and also the public comments today. I would just say, particularly on behalf of myself and Justice Marquez, we'd like to thank the Standing Committee for the last year and a half or more that you've spent working this thing over. But with that, let me turn the chair back over.
All right, thank you. And I want to thank everybody as well, of course, on behalf of the court. We'll be in recess.